Court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Simons versus Simons. Counsel, just give me one moment while we get people in and out of the courtroom. That appears to have been accomplished. Is it Mr. Kenny?
Yes, sir.
Good morning to you and Mr. Belmont.
Yes.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, sir.
Mr. Kenny, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is John Kinney. I represent the appellant, Jonathan Simons, in this appeal arising out of the Douglas County District Court related to a 16-year marriage, a prenuptial agreement, a business valuation, and alimony and child support issues. Frankly, the facts of the case read like a law school fact pattern in a family law class in law school. There's quite a few different issues that are present in the case. And before I begin speaking about the legal issues involved in our appeal, as I drove to Lincoln today, I was reminded of the case of Stevens versus Stevens. And the reason why I was thinking about that case is because that's a case that squarely addressed the contributions of a non-owning spouse to what is, well, prior to Stevens, may have been considered an entirely non-marital asset. I think this case is important because it allows us to consider Stevens and that notion that you could have a generational business with three or four generations of owners and an individual get married, and the non-owner spouse, according to Stevens, can make a claim to a sort of a conversion of the of those efforts in the business to have created a marital asset. Well, why is that important here? This case should have allowed Mr. Simons to carve out his non-marital asset, and it should have allowed him to, as Mr. Dvorak said very concretely in his testimony, to rely on title. And I was also
so thinking, what specifically are you arguing is the non-marital asset here?
Anything not titled jointly is a non-marital asset according to the prenuptial agreement that was the result of five iterations of discussion and negotiation by two independent lawyers. Title controls.
Isn't that constructive trust a means of vesting title?
Well, that is an interesting, what I consider to be, as I looked at the case law, a fiction. It's a legal fiction, and you can call it vesting title, but it's not formal titling. It's an equitable principle whereby we consider something to be a joint asset. But can
did,
we really?
Did the prenuptial agreement specify that formal title was to govern, or did it just use the term title?
Well, I think the important issue there is the section 4.6 that states that the marital asset can be created by an affirmative act resulting in the titling of additional property. And so I think what your question is how does, more specifically, how does that provision control what happened here? I don't think you can look at that phraseology in the prenuptial agreement and say that anybody was thinking about equitable principles of fraud and constructive trust when it came to an affirmative act of titling. Titling is what it means and what it says. If I think both of these parties knew that if they were going to have marital assets as part of their marriage and as something that you would contemplate as part of divorce that you would share, there had to be some sort of overt knowledge and discussion related to how that asset was going to be titled.
So there was no act of fraud or deception bad enough, no matter how bad it would have been, that constructive trust would have been appropriate?
No, I think in Manker versus Manker, where there was a gentleman who divorced his wife secretly after a year of marriage and then pretended to be married to her for another 15 or 20 years. I think that case probably merited a constructive trust. But in this case, the constructive trust and fraud allegations are so weak, especially as it relates to the time frame of 2009, that I don't think under these facts there's clear and convincing evidence in 2009 that Mr. Simons somehow kept his wife from seeing the closing documents, from asking questions, from being involved and active. She was a businesswoman.
I just want to make sure I understand your argument where you are here. From your response to my previous question, it sounds like there is the possibility that some facts could be bad enough that constructive trust could be appropriate under prenuptial agreements such as this. However, you're saying these facts here are not.
Well, there's a problem with due process in this case, and so, but I haven't even talked about that. But
that's about the notice and the pleadings and the admitting all that. I just mean on the question I had there, is that your position that as I summarize it, or am I missing the point?
You're not missing the point, but I don't want to get boxed in to having said something that I didn't really say,
or admitted something that I didn't admit.
And so I thought your question was, under Nebraska jurisprudence, is it possible in a divorce context for there to be facts that would lead a court to use equitable principles to impose a constructive trust and use equitable principles to find by clear and convincing evidence that somebody engaged in fraud? I think that's possible under Nebraska jurisprudence, and I've read other cases from other states where constructive trust and fraud have been
Is it possible when there's a prenuptial agreement like the one in this case?
Well, I would say no, because of the waiver in this case. It's so powerful. There's a waiver that both parties signed, again, with independent counsel.
Was that waiver brought up before the district court?
Well, I don't think it had to be. I mean, the prenuptial agreement contains the waiver.
Was that argument made to the district court, or is the first time this argument's been made to a court?
Waiver argument? No, the waiver argument was not, as far as I can tell, I wasn't trial counsel, but as far as I can tell from the briefing that went on, the waiver issue wasn't raised, but I don't think it had to be raised at any time at the trial or it was waived. The fact is that counsel for Mr. Simons clearly advocated the entirety of the prenuptial agreement being valid and being imposable on the parties. I don't know that she had to specify each paragraph or each section of the prenuptial agreement that needed to be imposed on the parties.
So your argument is it was up to the judge to raise the waiver clause defense?
I would say that a trial court should read the entirety of the prenuptial agreement, and if you have read the entirety of the prenuptial agreement, the waiver would have been clear to a finder of fact, and that the finder of fact, having found that the prenuptial agreement is valid, should have imposed the waiver language to defeat the constructive trust and fraud claims.
Is this what plain error review is for?
I guess plain error from what I sort of contemplate is that something not raised at the trial level. For example, the expert witness in this case used fair value, not to take a 90-degree turn. There was no real preservation of the admissibility of that expert's opinion. We're not arguing that opinion was not admissible, because we can't. We're arguing that it was unreliable and shouldn't have been used. So if this court were to find plain error in the admissibility of that opinion, that would be because it wasn't preserved in the record appropriately. I don't think you need to use plain error to impose the waiver in this case, because it's contractual and the court found that the prenuptial agreement was valid and enforceable. I preserved the error. When I prepared the brief and cited it as an error, I don't think it had to be raised as a specific issue for the court to have ruled on. The court ruled that the prenuptial agreement is valid. Therefore, the court ruled that the waiver language can be imposable on the parties. I see that I have only 43 seconds, so I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Belmont, good morning to you.
Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Ben Belmont, and I represent the appellee in these proceedings, Heather Simon. The issue in this appeal, from what I take from Mr. Kenny's argument, isn't the validity of the premarital agreement. The court found the premarital agreement to be valid. The issue is how the assets are to be characterized pursuant to that premarital agreement. The district court correctly found by clear and convincing evidence that three assets that were titled in appellant's name, JBS Kids Play, Dog Watch, and JBS Property, were done so fraudulently and should be held in a constructive trust for the benefit of the appellee, and that it would be inequitable and unjust for the appellant to retain the sole interest in those assets and that they'd be excluded as a result of the premarital agreement.
What factually, specifically, is the fraud in this case?
The parties together decided they were going to save their money living frugally to purchase a business together. They searched for the business together. They went to the business broker together. They found the business together. They went to the closing together, where appellant signed the closing document. Mr. Kenny referred to the closing document as a managing partner. They used money from their joint account to purchase the business. The appellant introduces Heather, my client, to the employees as the owner. They have a sign in the front, Exhibit 56, that says Heather and John Simon, owners. The appellant had business cards made for my client, Heather Simon's owner. Heather works her tail off for 10 and a half years in the business, in addition to raising the two children and taking care of a home. They introduce her at public events as an owner. They do everything together except one thing. Mr. Simons does not take Heather with him when he decides to form these three LLCs. For some reason, she's not involved in that. He's put these businesses into entities where he is the sole member. Never tells her that. Can't explain during cross-examination why Heather wasn't on the business. He couldn't tell me, did not know any reason why Heather Simons would not have believed she was a co-owner. He misled his wife, Your Honors, for 10 and a half years.
So that the district court implied fraud from this?
The district court found, but that was clear and convincing evidence. I mean, he led her to believe that she was an owner of the business, and then it turns out he knew all along she wasn't an owner if you looked at the premarital agreement, because it's single member LLCs.
Mr. Belmont, I'd like to ask you about our standard of review on this issue. In the ordinary divorce case where there was no claim of fraud, we would review de novo for abuse of discretion. If this were not a divorce case and it was a claim of fraud between unrelated parties, at least not married parties, we would apply a de novo standard for clear and convincing evidence. But we would not apply abuse of discretion in that context. Given that you've merged these two concepts into a single action, what is the appropriate standard of review as to this fraud claim? Wouldn't it be the same as if they were not married?
It would be sound in equity. You decide factual questions de novo on the record and reach independent conclusions.
And can give, but don't have to give weight to the trial court's findings.
When credible evidence is in conflict on material issues of fact, according to your own language, we consider and may give weight to the fact that the trial court observed the witnesses and accepted one version of the facts over another.
May give weight.
May give weight.
Permissible.
Correct.
All right. So that's the standard that you're advocating for on this issue.
That I believe the standard is when there's fraud brought up in this context.
Did you have to show fraud, or could you show abuse of a confidential relationship?
It could be fraud, misrepresentation, or abuse of a confidential relationship, which in this case, abuse of a confidential relationship is even more clear because there's testimony that Mr. Simon knew that his wife trusted him. He testified to that. And he goes on his own, and he puts these businesses, which she knew was supposed to be together, into, in essence, his own name. And there's a Maryland case in which we cite to in our brief that talks about that issue, and it talks about confidential relationships, and I believe it's Martin versus Farber, 510 A second 608, a 1986 Maryland case, which talks about the confidential relationships in the context of a premarital agreement, as this was. So either of those three, and I think we have all of them in this, and clearly there was a breach of that confidential relationship. The businesses, Your Honors, are marital. They, Justice Pappy, you raised a question about the title and whether it's formal title. If you go back and look at 1.5 of the premarital agreement, which defines the marital estate, it'll say a transfer of conveyance in the form of co-ownership, including, but it also says, but not limited to. And it lists tenancy in common, joint tenancy by the entirety, or community property. And it can also refer to as a constructive trust, where title gets put as a constructive trust, as in this case. Your Honors, there's no question in equity and in fairness and in good conscience after a 14 and a half year marriage, because it was going to sunset in another 6 months, I think, that my client would be entitled to 50% of that business. The district court did not err in finding by clear and convincing evidence that the appellant defrauded his wife or misled her or breached that confidential relationship and those to take advantage of that premarital agreement. Certainly would be unjust and unconscionable in allowing the appellant to retain 100% interest in those assets. Well, Mr. Kinney, made an issue about or discussed about evaluation. Your Honors, I would take a look at Exhibit 76, which the court accepted, which was the appellant's, Dan Morris's, recomputation of our expert's valuation on these entities. And it does take into consideration 28% for a discount for lack of marketability.
Why is there a discount for lack of marketability if this is a singularly owned business?
Should be.
What's the difficulty in marketing this?
I don't know that. I didn't file a cross appeal on that issue. It was our position that there shouldn't be any discounts in a divorce case.
The court found it was fair value, didn't it?
The court accepted, it may have put in its findings fair value, but it accepted the valuation of both Dan Morris, who was the appellant's expert, and Greg Haar, which was our expert, and it was, which does include the discount for lack of marketability.
Is it an assignment of error that the court used Heather's expert on valuation?
I don't think so.
How you read it?
Wasn't that a raised assignment of error?
That they use our, well, I think the raised assignment of error is that we use fair value in thinking that we use fair value, which in essence we use fair market value. And it was if you look at Exhibit 76, that's our expert's initial work with their expert's revisions to it and applying a 28% discount to get to $1.4 million.
So your value included a discount for marketability as well?
Our value did not, but they reworked our numbers.
And the court accepted?
The court accepted really a compilation of the two experts' numbers at $1.4 million. And he put, Mr. Morris put a 28% discount for lack of marketability.
But we don't know why there's a discount for lack of marketability in this situation.
Mr. Morris testified to something of what his position would have been. Mr. Hart said if you were going to apply a discount for lack of marketability, it would have been between 10 and 15%, and not 28%.
Typically, those are for closely held corporations where you don't have complete title to your name and you got to sell it subject to somebody else's percentage of ownership. Isn't that correct?
Agreed.
And that's not the case here.
That's not the case. I don't think this should have been applied to any discounts. But again, we didn't cross bill. I see my time's out. I would respectfully request that the decision of the district court be affirmed. If there's no further questions, thank you. Maybe excuse.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 37 seconds.
37 seconds, Mr. Kenny.
Your Honors, I would just point out very briefly that equitable principles should apply in this case, but they should apply in favor of Mr. Simons. If you look at how this case was decided, I use the word Frankenstein, but it's the worst possible scenario for Mr. Simons in terms of how the prenuptial agreement considered valid would be imposed upon him. And it's the worst possible scenario in terms of there being no ability to trace. There's $375,000 here of non-marital money that just disappears because of the way the equitable principles and the contract principles came together in some sort of a triple witching hour. That's all I have.
Counsel, on the issue of value, the expert's determination of value, is it a fair value? Is it fair market value? Which is appropriate?
In a divorce context, fair market value is the appropriate standard to use. And I disagree with Your Honor when it comes to marketability discounts, just in terms of you have to have the ability in every divorce to contemplate marketability discounts. I think that's why Mr. Haar went back and grinded a little bit and realized that he had probably made a mistake or that his opinion might not be admissible. It doesn't matter. If you have 100% ownership of a closely held corporation, that doesn't mean, and I know the accountants will tell us this, that doesn't mean that you can't apply a marketability discount. There are other issues to marketability in play. I think in this case, if you look at the record, this was a niche market. You'd have to find a very unique buyer to buy a backyard playset business. There are all sorts of issues that if you were going to sell this company to a willing buyer, that you would treat it differently than the majority of the owners of a corporation purchasing minority shares, which is the Model Corporations Act standard. That's how you treat minority shareholders fairly. The marketability discount definitely applies even if there's 100% ownership. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. That concludes arguments in Simons versus Simons. You are excused.